Good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for April 10th, 2018. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. The opinions expressed on Corporations and Democracy are those of our guests and the host and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. With so much news in recent weeks about gun violence, shootings at schools and businesses, and the March for Our Lives and the Second Amendment, it's a good time to visit the influence of money in politics from the nation's largest pro-gun rights lobby, the National Rifle Association, the NRA. So with us today to discuss the influence of the NRA's money in politics and take your questions is Joff West, the Money in Politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics, often referred to as its website, opensecrets.org. Joff joined the Center for Responsive Politics last year after 8 years working for Central Texas newspapers and nonprofit news organizations, where he covered state and local elections, government ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance. He holds a master's degree in investigative reporting from the Missouri School of Journalism, and was a graduate assistant for Investigative Reporters and Editors, that's IRE, and the National Freedom of Information Coalition. His most recent article at opensecrets.org is NRA Donations Spiked After Parkland Shooting. So let's discuss that and have a look at the NRA's money in politics. Joff West, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to share your information with us. This whole thing with the school shootings and all the other kinds of shootings has been kind of a downward spiral. There's been a really elevated moment lately where young people have been rising up to take control. But the way it's been is like the NRA head Wayne LaPierre, he gave a speech after the Parkland, Florida school shooting, and the solution is more guns, and this time guns for teachers. It's pretty amazing. The other thing that went along with that is the NRA's donation spiked after the Parkland shooting. That's kind of ghastly to think of school shootings as a fundraising opportunity for the NRA, but I guess that's the case. What's your take on all that?
Well, that was surprising. One thing that often happens after these high profile shootings is you have a spike in gun sales. That's generally what happens, and the way that's generally tracked is through a federal background check checks, which the FBI keeps track of. So what we wanted to do is look at take a different angle and look at how it affected contributions. You know, if NRA members felt compelled to donate more to the NRA's PAC after the shootings, and it was a little surprising. What we found after Parkland was an increase, and then we started going back and looking at the other shootings. We looked at the Orlando shooting, we looked at the Vegas shooting, and it pretty much holds true that, 7 days, a week to 2 days after the shooting, you get this spike of donations to the organization. And some of them are kind of surprising. I mean, in the Parkland case, one of the donations came from a person who lived a city over from Parkland. And that's obviously, we live in a democracy, and you have the right to donate who you want to. But just the spike itself was interesting, sort of a different way to look at how these shootings impact politics.
Yeah, no kidding.
There's one loose end from your article, and that was the NRA was a bit overwhelmed at that time. So was there anything eventually learned from their media office about why donations were so large after the shooting at that time?
Well, no. And that's, you know, the NRA is not the most media-friendly organization, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's you know, after shootings, or generally after shootings, there's generally sort of a media blackout, and they don't comment much. And in this specific case, they just never got back to us. And there'd been some follow-up reporting, and based on our original reporting, and they're just, you know, there's just no comment from them about the, you know, spike in donations.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting who we're dealing with here, our elected officials. They are intrinsically wealthy to begin with, I think.
Yes.
Your organization has looked into that. Do you want to give us a little portrait of these people that need help from the NRA?
Right. Yeah, they are, you know, they're certainly not on welfare. One of our sort of annual stories that we do is we look at, we estimate the net worth of members of Congress based on financial disclosures. So you're looking at the average congressman, average senator, net wealth is something like $3 million. Member of the House is about $900,000. So, you know, personally, they're certainly well off, but it takes a lot to run a campaign. For instance, the average winning senator in 2016, his campaign spent $10 million. So that, you know, and that's just the campaign. There was, if you add in outside spending, which includes outside spending groups, which would include the National Rifle Association, you're looking at double. So it's about $19 million to win a Senate race, at least in 2016, $9 million of which comes from outside funding. And some of that, of course, is the NRA.
So they really are needy here, it appears.
Yeah. Well, I think the takeaway is that, you know, these outside spending groups, whether or not it's, you know, super PACs or it's you know, a member organization like the NRA, or you know, a politically active nonprofit, an LLC, they are playing more and more of an important role in funding campaigns and getting politicians elected. You know, candidates are more dependent on that money than they have ever before. So.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I did was read through the comments from your most recent article at opensecrets.org, and I think there was 130 of them right now. So a few of those caught my attention. The one comment was that the gun manufacturers have their own lobby, and the bulk of NRA money is from its own individual members. Is that what you can confirm, or... do you know about that?
Yeah, sure. So the NRA is sort of, you have to look at it from a couple different angles. So what we were looking at is the NRA's Political Action Committee, which is called the Political Victory Fund. And under FEC rules, the only people who can donate to that organization, to that PAC, are NRA members or employees. So any contributions, you know, specifically from the NRA PAC comes from either members or employees. Which is actually a small amount of money that the NRA contributes to political races.
Mm-hmm.
The bulk of the money comes through the NRA's through the NRA itself, through its nonprofit organization, in outside spending. So the money doesn't go to the candidates. It goes towards buying you know, ads or basically electioneering outside or without coordinating with the campaign itself.
Okay, so it's not tracked then. You don't have visibility of that.
Well, it's tricky. We have half. We have half visibility. We know how they're spending the money for the most case, for the most part, but we don't know where, as far as the NRA, the nonprofit organization, where their money comes from. They do list money. They do list like membership dues, but for instance, if you know, if I gave, you know, I'm welcome to give you know, $5 million to the NRA. In its IRS form, in its 990 form, you know, you'll see the $5 million donation, but you won't see who it's from. And that money very often ends up in, it can end up, for, you know, for lobbying or, you know, outside spending, you know, by, by, broadcast ads. So it's tricky. We have sort of somewhat visibility into it.
Yeah. And one other comment said that the NRA contributed $200 million since 2000 to politicians in both parties that believe in the Second Amendment, or at least the current interpretation of the Second Amendment.
Let's see. So $200 million directly to candidates?
That was what one of the comments said. It said two politicians in both parties.
Well, what I've seen is there's a kind of a, they do give to both parties, but there's a really distinction between how much goes to the Republicans and how much goes to the Democrats.
Well, that's certainly the case. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty much a party affiliation there with NRA contributions. It's about 96 to, since 2012, about 96 to 98% of NRA spending has gone towards Republican candidates, either supporting the Republican nominee or against the Democratic nominee or Democratic opponent.
Okay, so with the independent spending and ads and such that would be against one candidate.
Exactly. Yeah, so the amount of money that they actually give to candidates, it's very small compared with the outside spending. For instance, I was just a few names like... you know, if you look back, if you look at the current members of Congress, so the top, you could say, benefactor of NRA spending would be John McCain. And he's received about $8 million in outside spending support. That includes money brought, you know, money spent on like broadcast ads supporting him, and also, you know, ad spending and other electioneering costs against his opponent. So that's about $8 million. The amount of money that that his campaign has received directly from the NRA through its through the NRA PAC is $37,000. So you see, it's, you know, there's very little that actually goes to the candidates these days. It's mostly an outside spending, but the way we calculate it is basically, I mean, we put all that data together to look at how different organizations, PACs, what they spent in support of a particular candidate.
I'm looking at a list, I think it was on CNN, where they had the top individual donors to the cause to not have any gun control. And it was interesting to me that half of the top 10 were from Texas. I know you're familiar with Texas.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, actually, and what was I looking at? I was looking at Federal Background Check, the Federal Background Check database recently, and I was curious. It was the state with the highest number of a federal background check registration. The way that works is, you know, when somebody applies for a gun, a firearm, their information is sent to the FBI, their sort of background check division. They do the background check, and they store how many applications have been sent to them. So California is number one, Texas is number two. So That's not surprising.
No.
Yeah.
So then also the gun industry itself, I guess people don't always think about that when they think of the NRA, but there's Smith & Wesson and Browning, they're always lobbying for free access to guns and with no restrictions, I guess. That's
Yeah, it's good for business, obviously. You know, I mean, you got to imagine, you know, if one of the policy considerations, or at least one of the things that has been brought up post Parkland is raising the age, you know, to buy these semi-automatic rifles from 18 to 21. So you think of, you know, you think that you could imagine, you know, now you're taking a certain amount of people. You can no longer basically sell that firearm to, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly would not help the, would hurt the, you know, gun industry. So, but yes, they also do have their own independent lobbying organizations that, lobby at the federal level.
I guess one thing that's kind of important for us to get a hold of is that the NRA, for all the money it throws around, it's not really as big as a lot of the powerful interest groups. I guess their ace in the hole is not that they have so much, it's that opposition to gun control has so little. I mean the people that are for gun control don't really have a pressure point.
Yeah, it's true. You know, part of the brilliance of the National Rifle Association, you know, part of their marketing, really the brilliance of the marketing is they have a very simple message, which is don't take away our guns. And it, you know, we have a right to own guns under the Second Amendment, and you know, that is in period, and they oppose any sort of form of pretty much any form of gun regulation. So it's a very simple message, you know, and especially plays out in politics during campaigns, and you saw that in the presidential election between Trump and Clinton. I mean, Trump's message was very clear, very understandable, which is, if you elect Clinton, she'll take away your guns. It was, you know, you can say it in a sentence, and people understand it. The other side of the argument is a little difficult. I mean, when you talk about gun regulation, what are we talking about? There are a lot of different policy ideas. You know, that extends from, you know, raising the minimum age to buy semi-automatic rifles to magazine capacities, you know, even concealed carry laws. So it's very difficult to, as far as from the gun control, for gun control organizations, it's very difficult for them to find sort of, it has been difficult for them to sort of have a simple, direct message that can resonate. And you can say it, you can say it quickly in a sentence. Unlike the NRA, which is quite clear about what they believe in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have not looked at their policies or proposals other than the, you know, the quotes and Wayne LaPierre being in the news and such, but
sure.
But the courts, you know, have clearly upheld bans on semi-automatic weapons, and you know, the Supreme Court has refused to hear appeals. Actually, this is from the comments to your article. One comment is, the Supreme Court has twice refused to hear appeals on semi-automatic weapon bans in Connecticut and Maryland, apparently. And one of the cases states assault weapons and large capacity magazines are not protected by the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. So I, but I haven't noticed it. So is the NRA opposed or complained about those court positions, because those don't take guns away from law-abiding citizens as the NRA seems to be. But it does would limit availability to criminals. Mm-hmm. So, have you noticed anything about the NRA has to say about those facts in the courts?
Well, it's their general, their sort of game plan or the way they approach it is if you give an inch, they'll take a yard. It is clear that in the 2008 the Supreme Court ruled in Heller versus D.C. That was actually the first case where the Supreme Court took up the issue of whether or not the Second Amendment applied to an individual's right to own a gun, and they ruled that they ruled in Heller's favor. He was a resident of D.C. who wasn't able to, basically own a gun in the district.
Mm-hmm.
So the ruling was, yes, it does apply to individuals. But in that ruling, there were a lot of caveats. There were a lot of exceptions. It was clear that you can't do a blanket ban, but you can regulate it. The justices, they gave some examples of that. And so that's why the cases in for instance Connecticut, which after they put the ban on assault or semi-automatic rifles, there appeared to be a dip in gun deaths. Although that is something I read. I haven't gotten too deep in that, but mm-hmm. My guess is the reason that that's not going up higher in the courts is because it's already been set. Basically, by the Supreme Court, that you can regulate it, you just can't. You can't do a blanket ban.
You can't just ban
on firearms in general. Total ban on firearms.
You were talking about some of the things that people were doing legally to restrict gun use. That's sort of out of control, as far as I'm concerned. Is one in Oregon, I think, and other places where they're the boyfriend loophole is. To disallow guns legally in the hands of people convicted of domestic violence. It'd be another way to go.
Yeah, and there's other things like there have been bills in Congress which would ban people who are on no-fly lists from owning a gun, which is did not pass, or people with mental illness. That hasn't gone anywhere. So there's some policies that at least according to polling would suggest that a vast majority of Americans and even gun holders or gun owners also agree with. I was looking at a Pew Research study back in June. It was really fascinating. So just on the, one of the policy considerations or one of the policies pushed by gun control advocates is closing the so-called background check loophole, which is the loophole is you don't need to do a background check if you do a private sale at a gun show or online. And so in the poll, and Pew found that, 77%, which is kind of amazing, 77% of gun owners supported background checks at gun shows, at private sales and at gun shows. And 87% of non-gun holders. So if you put it together, it's about 84%. 82% of gun owners supported banning gun purchases for those on no-fly lists. This was kind of amazing, 48% of gun owners supported banning semi-automatic rifles. So half of the gun owners in America, in the U.S., adults, obviously, supported that, which was kind of unbelievable.
That's what makes this story so amazing, is that most of the people, like you say, 84%, are for gun regulation, and yet we can't seem to make it happen. It seems very strange, and I guess part of it is, like you're saying, the genius of the NRA organizing. They have 5 million members, and they pay, what, $35 a year to support their membership? But that's a lot of people. And the other thing I noticed, that they do spend money on youth shooting programs, so they're really looking ahead, too.
Yeah.
I know they had one here locally. The Friends of the NRA had a dinner in Fort Bragg with it was for money for youth shooting programs. Not shooting youth like we've been seeing having, but teaching them to shoot. But some of the militarization of the decor was a little startling. Like, you could buy a shock and awe table for $1,400. It was very youthful decor. The ambience certainly was more military, but their direction is to look ahead to the future generations.
And that's one of the, it's sort of donations or grants to youth rifle programs or these youth clubs. That's part of how they maintain their nonprofit status. They have to show, obviously, that they are not just keeping the money for political reasons but also doing, sort of community outreach or member outreach spending and donations. So that's part of it.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a moment to remind listeners that this is Corporations and Democracy, and we are discussing the influence of money from the National Rifle Association, the NRA, in politics. And our guest is Geoff West. He is the money and politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics. That's opensecrets.org. And listeners who would like to join the conversation and ask our guest any questions can call us here at 895-2448. That's area code 707-895-2448.
Yeah, so this is like, we're dealing with this big contradiction. Well, we have a call. Let's go to the call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I apologize because I am bedridden, but I am calling because you hit it right on the head. My radio will still be, hopefully, in the dark background. I'm underneath the covers. I'm 80 years old. And you hit on the point that youth is being encouraged. And through ROTC, Reserve Officer Training, at the high schools, which we sanction. And basically, that ROTC not only involves a lot of lead in their loading and exploding of the material, but also it involves a mental indoctrination. My radio, of course, is going on, and I'm of the impression that I'm not on the air. Am I correct?
No, you are on the air. There is a delay. You're supposed to turn your radio down so you aren't confused by that.
I apologize. The major thing is that our nation has turned into a military nation, and the ROTC and the NRA is just part and parcel of keeping this killing industry in just about every nation in this world where we have active military bases, is the fact that over a decade ago, there was a very clean analysis of people in prison. And the fact is that close to 90% of, or over, are those people that are incarcerated, male and female, but especially male, including Manson. his lead levels in his blood basically indicates that he should be dead, is that the majority of the people that are incarcerated are there due to lead poisoning. They are crazy. They have been made insane. Well, once we took it out of the gasoline and we discouraged it from children eating it off of their windowsills, we basically have enforced it through the NRA and their youth indoctrination systems and our requirement that our schools give ROTC, those young men out there, of which every effort was made in high school because I was an autistic and had other learning disabilities, but I was artistic. But they tried to get me into ROTC, and one of the things they tried to do is to you have a brotherhood. Finally, you have people you can associate with, and guess what? You're moving around, and they're educating you that you are no longer part of the civil liberties or the Constitution. You are part of a military-industrial brotherhood that must stay together and must have order, their order. And I'll get off the line because I know you guys can run with this. This is lead poisoning. This nation is the greatest killer nation in the world. And we're in the majority of the nations of the world. And we're not ready to start it through Israel to go for Iran. I love your program. I love you guys.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your comments. Yeah, so we certainly have more than just the youth marksmanship programs. We have ROTC.
Yeah, and it was interesting. He makes a really good point and a really good connection there. You know, the NRA originally was founded, you know, many, many years ago as an organization to promote sort of gun stewardship, mm-hmm. you know, and kind of in a way to prepare people for if they were ever called into service, they knew, you know, how to use a rifle. And it was, you know, that was kind of what they were founded on. And it's changed. But, you know, this teaching young people how to, you know, handle a rifle, that goes back to sort of the foundation of the organization. It's obviously changed since, though.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me of a little factoid I'll mention to local listeners, and this is regarding the issue of gun registration and this kind of thing, which is a hot topic of gun issues. But right here in the county, there was a time when guns were not so much registered. But I guess informally registered, and that was at the bequest of the county sheriff during World War II, because he didn't know when the Japanese might arrive on the beaches. You know, was a practical issue back at that time, and it's what is, you know, so it's 70-something years ago now, but that occurred once here out of necessity.
On the background check issue, I just wanted to throw this in really quick. So I was looking at the top 10 highest weeks for applications to purchase guns. This is through the FBI's database. Mm-hmm. So the top 10 weeks going back since 1998, so you can sort of do the calculation there. The eighth highest week was the week after March for Our Lives, so that was February 26th mm-hmm. through March 4th, 2018. So what we're seeing is there, you know, applications for gun purchases. Anyways, just wanted to throw that in.
Yeah, thanks. One of the things that this brings up, talking about, you know, our local purchase of guns, people do have some kind of say over what their sheriffs and police departments do, and they all buy guns from the gun industry. So there is one place where people might be wanting to pay attention on who our taxpayers are supporting in the industry. Yeah. I don't know if you have any comments on that or not.
Well, you make an interesting point. So the NRA, there's been reporting that the NRA offers free memberships to local police forces for various reasons. You know, and that's and that part of that, I think, is because of obviously membership levels are important to the NRA for a variety of reasons. So you have, you know, you have local law enforcement, not everywhere, but there are some cases that there's sort of a, you know, you're part of this, you know, county sheriff's or, you know, small police, small town police department. You are an NRA member. There is sort of some coordination there.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, for anyone who'd like to call in, it's 895-2448. And I would like to ask a question looking forward to upcoming elections and actually looking backward a whole week, because the NRA was spoken of in the election results and apparently during the election the campaigning for the in a race in Wisconsin that occurred, and it was just a week ago on Tuesday. And in that election, it was for a Supreme Court justice position for the state, and the winning side was a very clearly a liberal judge versus a very conservative one supported by the NRA in some means. And the liberal judge candidate, you know, won solidly. And even said, you know, we beat the NRA was one of the comments afterwards. So what do you know about that? What happened there and the NRA's role and such?
So the NRA was very vocal in support of the Republican candidate for the Supreme Court. And it was, you know, it was kind of bad timing, if you look at it from the NRA's standpoint. Just shortly before the Parkland shooting, Chris Cox, who is the head of the NRA's Political Action Committee, that's the Political Victory Fund, you know, came out in support and was quoted as saying, you know, this is, if you believe in the Second Amendment, come out and vote for the Republican candidate. And then the shooting happened at Parkland, and it was, you know, it was the Democrat sort of. I mean, she Dallin, I believe her name, you know, was very vocal on Twitter and in, you know, public appearances that her opponent had the support of NRA and. And also, she was, you know, she came out in opposition to access to semi-automatic rifles, the AR-15 specifically. So, you know, you have a sort of a sensitive, you know, time in our country, and you know, after the shooting, and you have a candidate who says, "I think we should ban these things." And then she can point to her opponent who says, who has the backing of the NRA. And so, now whether or not that changed the results of the election, it's hard to tell. It could just be a case of, sort of a, it could be a Trump effect, you know, some, disappointment or disillusion with, the Republican Congress we have now or Trump as president. She ran ads with Trump as you know, featuring Trump quite extensively in her campaign ad. So it's kind of hard to tell whether or not the NRA's backing of the conservative candidate is what swung the election, but it certainly was. You know, a bad time for bad time for the shooting in terms of where it was in the election. I mean, it's just shortly before the election day.
Looks like there might be some payback on the way.
There was a caller a moment ago, by the way, that dropped off while we were having our last discussion. So
If you call, I'll pick you up, but don't say anything until I introduce you so we can give the guest a chance to answer their questions, and I can keep you from being cut off by the phone company. Here's a call right now. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm going to put in two quick factoids.
Okay.
Shall I wait?
No, go right ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, two quick factoids is the fact that all of the young people, the young men who have fired on their peers have been ROTC people. And with the vast majority of the mature men who have fired on their humans, including the Las Vegas man, and going all the way back into the Texas University shootings, they have all had macho domestic violence. And if those kind of people can be analyzed, including T. Rump, who has his own issues, who immediately, whenever he walked in, the first thing he signed was that he said that Obama's ban on people who are being financially solely supported by Social Security, etc., because they are insane, could not get firearms. That was the first thing Trump did.
Okay. What was your second point there? You said two factoids?
Yeah, and I think this is your second call, so... Oh, did he just hang up? I guess so. Okay, well, thanks for your call. One thing that I did notice, that looking around on the internet, there is a National African American Gun Association, and they promote gun ownership, but they support gun regulation. So it can be done, I have found. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with them?
Sure. Yeah, I did. I read a little bit. I noticed them. There was a story, I think, on NPR recently about them. I looked in our database to see if they had done any lobbying or had any sort of PAC that contributed to any candidates. So they're not doing any of that. So they're not showing up as doing any sort of activity in at least federal politics. It's true. You know, going back to the Pew study, it's even among gun owners, there's support for some of the gun control measures that have been pushed by gun control advocates. There are a lot of gun owner member organizations, outside of the NRA, state level, local level. So there's, if you own a gun, you can be a member of an association that isn't necessarily the NRA, and they very well may have different, policy agendas or mm-hmm. beliefs.
Back to the issue of campaigns from a few minutes ago. So do you know of any others on the horizon where the NRA has a particular visibility? And why don't we hold the answer because another call is coming in?
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I was just calling, listening to you guys' discussion. And you're talking a lot about guns being the problem. And from what I've seen and is obvious, guns don't fire themselves. People are usually the problem when it comes to guns. So I want to just state that, but I would also like to hear what everybody, the two interviewers and the guests, what would you guys do if you had it to do yourselves? How would you arrange the gun situation in the United States? Would you take all the guns away? Would you just take them away from, white males?
I think that probably that I'm going to talk for the three of us, and the other two can contradict me if they don't agree with me. But I think it's all they're talking about is some safety regulations like you do with a car. Nobody's taking anybody's car away from them. They're saying you have to know how to freaking drive it. And so that's the way I interpret the gun regulation.
Right, okay.
People.
I hear that and I understand. Wouldn't it then be better to train everybody? Not everybody, but to train people, like, you know, like, I don't know much about the ROTC, what the other caller was talking about, but then wouldn't you favor gun training and not maybe proliferation of guns, but to have people receive the training, be introduced to the firearms in a controlled environment with experts, to have that discipline, to have that awareness? Wouldn't that be what do you think of that approach?
I think that is a large part of some of the gun control ordinances, but let me have our guest respond to that. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
Well, you know, gun ownership in the U.S., it's been estimated about 30% of U.S. adults, about 40% of U.S. adults live in homes where there are guns. You know, and a lot of gun deaths are accidental shootings from people, you know, often children or teens who, or others who don't, you know how to use a firearm. So, you know, if you're going to have a gun in the home, you know, absolutely, there should be training. You should teach whoever could potentially have access to it to know how to handle it. As far as what to do policy-wise at a federal level, I wouldn't, you know, the thing that I think we would, as an organization, and I would like to see is better transparency of, you know, where the money that the NRA, not just the NRA, but all many organizations who contribute extensive amount of money towards campaigns in elections, where that money is coming from, because we don't know. We just, you know, there's just little transparency over whose money is buying ads, or whose money is attempting to influence policy and you know, public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be something that I would be interested in knowing. Mm-hmm. That would be my wish list, I guess.
There's a comment or two I'll make on that. First of all, the most recent caller did address something an issue that the first caller did mention. And that is, the first caller said that most of the people that are doing mass shootings do have training of one kind or another, often in junior ROTC or this kind of thing. I had not heard that before, although the shooter in Parkland, I believe, did have experience from that. And the shooter at the in Las Vegas, he planned so carefully for what he was doing. I don't know what training he had previously. He must have had some, though, because he was estimating the drop of bullets from the elevation and the distance that he was shooting from. So there was a guy that you know, very clearly knew a lot about weaponry. And what I wanted to talk about on the program is just some of the basic facts or claims made. Again, sure. This is going back to, you know, the comments from your that are online at your article. And one of them is quoted a couple times that there was a 10-year ban on assault weapons, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, in the years following, there was like three times as many mass shootings as during the 10-year ban. That's mentioned a couple times. I haven't double checked that to find an exact source for it. So if there's any comments you have, I'd be glad to know. But that's one of the statistics that seems relevant to me. But what do you think?
Right. And let's see. I was going to pull up some data on that. If we're talking about mass shootings, that's inaccurate. I should also say this: there is no official definition of what is a mass shooting. There is no federal you know, a federal definition of it, mandated sort of. It's not codified. So it's sort of accepted that if it's over, say, four people have been shot, that's a mass shooting. If you go off of that, the numbers have only increased nearly every year. So I don't know. I don't believe that's accurate.
The numbers that were quoted specifically during the ban, 12 mass shootings during a 10-year ban, less than 100 victims, less than 100 dead. And since 2004, when the ban expired, there's been at least 36 mass shootings with more than 400 dead. No, that's the claim again in the comments. So,
you know, we're running out of time, and I would like to spend a little time talking about Open Secrets itself, because
sure.
that's a really rich website for people that want to understand the situation and figure out
sure.
what to do about
sure.
it. So what can you tell us about the Center for Responsive Politics and OpenSecrets.org? How does that work? What is going on over
sure.
there?
Well, we are nonpartisan nonprofit organization in D.C. and we track everything from quarterly lobbying reports to dark money spending to broadcast ads in specific geographic regions and obviously monthly and quarterly reports as far as what campaigns and organizations are spending and bringing in. So what we do is we draw primarily off of FEC data, and we take the raw data and we're able to code it into different ways of looking at it, so you can look at it by sort of PAC contributions, by industry, by sector, lobbying by tech companies. We also have a foreign lobby watch, which tracks foreign lobbying in the U.S., and so we have a searchable database that on our website that people can put in a country or a name and see what sort of foreign lobbying is happening at the federal level. So we look at it from a lot of different angles, and when we're here as a resource for news organizations, academics, and obviously constituents, people in in your county, and to look up hey, how much is my representative, how much is received from X organization or whatever. So it's very much we try to give you as much information as possible.
You clearly document the rise in outside spending after the Citizens United decision. That's in there's a document at your site called "The Top 10 Things Every Voter Should Know About Money in Politics."
Yeah, so I would recommend that. We have a section, so it's opensecrets.org, and on the top right, you go to resources, and there's a lot of. It's where we have a primer just to get people aware about how money in politics works, and that's a great document which you mentioned there.
Mm-hmm. I left a loose end a few minutes ago when we took the last caller, and that was about any shall I call them juicy races that on the horizon where the NRA has visibility and it's and part of the controversy over any elections coming up. Do you know any offhand that come to mind?
Well, so the NRA, as far as NRA's influence, one sort of interesting bit would be, obviously Rick Scott recently announced.
Oh, yes, just yesterday.
For Senate.
Yeah.
And so that should be interesting because of, you know, obviously what happened with Parkland and the signing of some gun control regulations in Florida. So, you know, obviously that is a race to watch. And the NRA has... you know, they've been somewhat active in the special elections we've had. In Alabama, they were they spent about a little over $1 million on behalf of Luther Strange, which it didn't work out. But you know, obviously Doug Jones, a Democrat, won that election. In Montana, they were supporting Greg Gianforte, the Republican, and he ultimately did win. So, so they are, I guess you could say, one for one special elections.
Okay, and that's opensecrets.org, and you can find out more. There's a learning center, there's all the research, and there's even features with some really interesting stuff written about lobbyists and all kinds of mishandling of your money by our guest here. Not mishandling by our guest, writing about it by our guest, Jeff West.
Yes, including a couple of articles then you've done since you arrived at the organization last year.
And we have to say goodbye because we are out of time.
Okay, well, Jeff West at opensecrets.org, thanks for being our guest and taking calls from the public up here.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And you've been listening to Corporations and Democracy. It's broadcast each second and fourth Tuesday at from 1 to 2 here on KZYX and Z. The next edition will be in 2 weeks, April 24th, with host Linda McClure. Annie and I will return on Tuesday, May 14th.